Hi, I'm Tony Rossi for The Christophers, and today's show will feature the conclusion of my interview with best-selling suspense novelist Dean Koontz. Dean and I will cover a lot of ground, including his work with a charity for children with disabilities, his experience of faith, prayer, and the supernatural, and why he sees sacredness and beauty in the world around us. Stay with us. Christopher Close-Up starts right now. Hello and welcome to Christopher Close-Up. I'm Tony Rossi, and on our last episode, I was joined by best-selling author Dean Koontz. Dean talked about his novel, The City, a story about a young boy named Jonah Kirk, who grew up with a loving mother and grandfather in the 1960s, but had some life-changing experiences of good and evil. Like all of Dean's novels, the story includes elements of the supernatural, of the presence of God in the midst of the world's darkness, and that reflects Dean's own worldview, that our lives have purpose and meaning and are full of grace and wonder. Dean also shared parts of his own upbringing, like being raised by a very loving mother, but by an abusive father, which gave him examples of the world's light and darkness at an early age. When time ran out on our last show, Dean and I kept talking about topics like faith, prayer, love, and beauty, along with his books The City, another book called Innocence, and the popular Odd Thomas series. We are going to get to all of those today, so here now is the conclusion of my Christopher Close-Up interview with Dean Koontz. I also want to touch on the novel Innocence a little bit, because one of your gifts seems to be seeing the beautiful in people that the world might avoid or even call ugly, and that was especially a theme I thought in Innocence. How has your concept of beauty evolved over the years?
Well, of course, we all see the external beauty of things and of people, but the older you get, or at least the older I get, the more the internal beauty seems to matter more. Mm-hmm. And I think partly that came from, we have worked now for 30, must be closing in 30 years, with an organization called Canine Companions for Independence. And they provide assistance dogs for people with severe disabilities, paraplegics, quadriplegics, spina bifida children. Mm-hmm. They are providing dogs now to autistic children, and it can take away, in many, many cases, almost all of the bad behavior just by having a socializing dog with you at mm-hmm. all times. And in the course of this, I've met hundreds of severely disabled people, some with such disabilities from birth that people would be, to some degree, some people would be repelled. But what I have found is that in all these years, I haven't heard one of them complain. I haven't heard one of them whine about anything in their lives. And mm-hmm. they have much more to struggle with than other people do. And it starts making you look and think, what is it within, what strength or what quality of character is it that this person has become so much more pleasant to be around than many people with all their faculties? And I think it comes back to very possibly that, unfortunately, because of your disability, you learn humility, mm-hmm. which a lot of us take our whole lives to learn and discover. And I think the book like Innocence, probably that's part of the genesis of that. I've, over the years, had quite a number of characters who are disabled. There's, from the corner of his eye, there's an 11-year-old girl with a deformed hand and who wears a leg brace, but who is the most radiant character in the book. Mm-hmm. And or Down syndrome. I've used that a couple of times because I've seen in a lot of Down syndrome people that gentleness of spirit, say, that that the world would be better off if there were considerably more of it.
Yeah. Well, I also noticed you also create a number of characters with autism. It's almost like they seem to see some mysteries of the universe that the rest of us miss. Is that based on something you've seen, too, in your workings with Canine Companions?
There are different kinds of autism. I think it's in By the Light of the Moon, the character has Asperger's syndrome or mm-hmm. something very like it, which is a sort of higher functioning to a degree mm-hmm. Autism. But Yeah, I think that there's definitely, this is part of what I mean by the world being so mysterious. You look at people or situations which should seem to be hopeless or dark, and they aren't. So it's kind of fascinating to me. For instance, when I've written about Down syndrome character in a major way, which I did in two different novels, I get nothing from mail from families that have a Down syndrome. Mm-hmm. I get nothing from them except they all say, this child, at first we thought, how are we going to cope? But now, you know, our son is 20-something, or I just got a letter the other day from a woman whose Down syndrome child is 45, and in every one of them says, this is the greatest good thing that ever happened to us. Then they go on to tell you why, and they're always very convincing. How the world works is different than we think if we don't see the wonder of it.
Right, and you're probably one of the only instances they see of Down syndrome depicted in a positive way, or even other families with kids with disabilities. Because it's not, I mean, not that I watch tons of television, but I watch enough to know that it's, you know, I don't see it everywhere. So your message that you're showing in your books is probably very affirming for them.
I think so, but it's sincere. I'm not saying, let me do this because nobody else has done it.
Right. Well, another element of innocence is Addison's relationship with his mother. I mean, she tried to love him, but because of something about him, which I won't really reveal, she describes him as a unique burden. How did you come to see that there are instances in life when love, as wonderful as it can be a burden?
You're getting some pretty deep questions, and I don't know that I've thought about where that comes from, but it probably goes back to now that I'm thinking about it. I suppose my mother had to love my father because she stayed with him and endured just endless humiliation, endless affronts of all kinds, and there had to be some love there, not just everything I saw. And maybe that love had withered almost away over the years, but maybe the memory of what it had been in the beginning was still strong enough to keep her with him and enduring what she endured. She died at 53, mm-hmm. And I think it was largely because she was just worn out from the life she lived there with him, and she died of a series of strokes.
Okay.
That might be partly where that came from, because if she did love him, it was a burden.
Okay. Well, do you still talk to your mom, pray to your mom, you know, even though she's not, since we're, you know, your books are very otherworldly, do you still do that?
Yeah. I have my little prayer time is every evening down on the back patio, my extended period of the day, and the dog comes with me. It's a golden retriever, and there's something just very wonderful about that. I sometimes think the dog joins in its own way. And she sits there and sniffs the world while I give my thanks for all the wonderful things my life has been full of. Sort of that's the same thing that is the theme of the city, is that in the end, the great things are people. Mm-hmm. Anna probably is thanking them for the smell of the roses and for the smell of the bird going by and the rabbit under the bush and whatever.
Right.
But mine generally is about the people gone and the people still here.
Yeah. Well, last time we talked, part of the discussion was about your dog Trixie, who had passed away, and you described her as a theophany, a visible manifestation of God. Does Trixie's impact on your life continue, even though she's gone for a number of years now?
Yeah, absolutely. That dog, I wrote a whole book explaining how that dog changed me. Mm-hmm. And it was focusing you on the small things in life again, because you get very busy. And when the career is working, you want it to work better and you want to achieve more. That's just a natural thing. And you get tied up in busyness and all kind of claims on your time come in. And you start looking at things in a macro sense instead of a micro sense. But the dog looks at everything in the simplest way, and you could, as an example I gave, you could take the same walk maybe every morning for 10 years, and you no longer see anything on the walk. But you take that same walk with a dog for the next 10 years, and every day you'll see things that you had overlooked before, because the dog is interested in every little thing along the route and will stop to examine this or look at that or smell this, and it makes you stop and see things in a different way and begin to see again the wonder and the beauty of the most mundane things. The beauty of the world is so astonishing that you have to, it's not me who came up with this thought, but the beauty of the world is not a necessity. The world would work just fine if everything was mechanical, as we're told it is. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't need beauty in a world like that. Beauty is for other reasons, and you don't need it in a world that's entirely mechanical. And once you begin to reacquaint yourself with the beauty of the small things in life, and that's one of the big things that dog did for me, then your sense of wonder grows and just keeps on growing.
Right. And I just want to read this quote you used to open the city from Thomas Mann. Hold every moment sacred, give each clarity and meaning, each the weight of thine awareness, each its true and due fulfillment. So that's really what Trixie did for you, to teach you about the sacredness of every moment.
Yep, that's exactly right. And that's essentially the core theme of this book, that even the small moments, what happens to Jonah Kirk in this book by the end, if you go back to the beginning, you look at all the little moments which he begins to see by the end. Some very small things turned out to have very major impact. And some encounters, there's an encounter he makes with Mr. Yoshioka upstairs that seems like a very small moment, but eventually grows into one of the two or three great relationships of his life.
Right, right. Well, staying with the city, Jonah has an encounter with a woman called Miss Pearl, who is something of a supernatural entity, and he's reluctant to tell anyone about her. And when I read that part, I was reminded of this story of St. Therese of Lisieux having this experience of a vision of the Virgin Mary smiling at her, and she was reluctant to talk about it. And when she finally did, she regretted it because of the way people reacted. Do you think we sometimes have these supernatural experiences that are meant for us alone to affirm us in our beliefs?
You know, I've had a few.
Okay.
And I will, and the older I get, and in fact, I had an experience, I won't go into it, I might mm-hmm. write about it someday, but for exactly that reason, either it ends up being mocked, or either it ends up, you're considered kind of daffy.
Yeah.
And, but I've had a few experiences, and I had one not terribly long ago. I can't go into it, but it was just, let me say, I saw something, and it was at night. I woke up, and I saw this, and I thought, I'm still asleep. And I thought, no, I'm awake. This has to be real. And mm-hmm. I sat up in bed and reached out to touch this, and Gerda said, just lie down. You're not meant to touch it. It'll go away. Mm-hmm. And I was astounded because it was a shared experience. And I thought, okay, then I'm not asleep. And she's got greater equanimity about these things than I do. But I think the more you open yourself to the world and the way it truly is, the more you are open-minded. This is what amazes me about the view of faith in modern times, is that the faithful are closed-minded. I think it depends on the faith you're talking about. Mm-hmm. But no, I tend to find that they're more open-minded, and that those who insist that there is no meaning are by their very definition closed-minded.
Right, right. No, as you're saying that, I was reminded of this quote from a C.S. Lewis, Jennifer Fulweiler, whose book you endorsed. I interviewed her a few weeks ago, and she has this quote in her book, God shows much more of himself to some people than to others, not because he has favorites, but because it's impossible for him to show himself to a man whose whole mind and character are in the wrong condition. Now, I guess in your life and in your characters, your characters seem to notice when God is talking to them. So what is the condition they're in? Is it the humility you talked about earlier, that wonder?
I think it is that wonder, that sense of humility that can be difficult to hold on to in life. But I think that's core to it, because as I was saying about people with disabilities, so many of them accept their situation with a serenity, and that we would think, oh, I couldn't do that. I'd be angry. But all the time I'd be bitter, but maybe you don't have to be. Maybe it's that humility that is taught by that disability that actually lifts them up to a different level.
Right.
And so I think that's key. That's why Odd Thomas, the character, his fundamental characteristic is his unshakable humility. And that doesn't mean he's a milquetoast or anything. It means,
no,
in fact, quite the opposite. That's, I think, a condition for being able to see the world in a different way. If you're totally full of yourself and you think everything you do matters more than anything else, then, yeah, I would agree with Jennifer. You can't be approached by God because it's you're not ready for it.
Yeah. I'm talking to author Dean Koontz. Before we wrap up, I do want to touch on Odd Thomas because you just mentioned him. And the seventh book, the final book, it seems, is coming out December 2014 called Saint Odd. How would you describe your journey with this character in this seven-book-long story?
It actually, there is a little book called Odd Interlude that came in the middle of it all, so there's almost eight books.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Odd Interlude was only in paperback and ebook at first. And yeah, when that started, that was one of those books that is mystifying to me. I was working on a novel called The Face, and in the middle of writing that novel, the words came into my head, and my name is Odd Thomas, I lead an unusual life. And it had nothing to do with what I was writing, but I recognized it as a scrap of something and maybe the start of something. So I turned to a legal pad I keep beside me to make notes. And I wrote it down, and the next thing I know, though I never before or since have ever written longhand a novel, I started writing longhand, and I just spent a few hours at my desk writing longhand, and I ended up with the whole first chapter of the novel, and nothing like that had ever happened to me before or since, but I could hear that character's voice as if somebody was talking to me, and I just wrote it down. I thought, well, I have to go back and finish The Face, but when I get back to these notes, they're going to turn out to be incoherent or I think they're garbage. It's only the enthusiasm of the moment. But in reality, when I went back to them, they were almost word for word the exact first chapter that appeared in the book.
So, wow.
So I saw that Odd was something, it was a grace, and I had just needed to follow him. And my publisher at that time hated the character so much.
Really?
Yes.
I'm shocked.
And he wouldn't talk to me about the book. It was only later when booksellers started praising it and ordering it and increasing their orders, and then the early reviews came in, and they were all very good reviews, that he began to, he still wouldn't talk to me about the book. He disliked it so much. But then he would contemplate not telling me what to write. He said, I'll never again tell you what to write. And as a consequence, he did accept that I could go on to write other Odd novels as long as I did different ones between. And Odd has been an amazing journey for me. He's ended up doing things that I didn't think he would get to the point of being able to do. For instance, as Odd puts it, when you're in defense of the innocent, there are no innocents. As long as you're moral, there are no restraints. The same thing that a soldier on a battlefield fighting in World War II against the Nazis would have had to feel and know that he's on the side of innocence, he's on the side of truth, and therefore, when you kill in a war like that, it isn't murder. There's a difference between those things. And Odd had to come to that acceptance, which has been a very, very terrible thing for him, that from time to time, somebody, he, to protect the innocent, he has to kill someone who is particularly evil. And it doesn't come easily to him, and I think that's why the publisher, this was supposed to be an action hero, you see. And action heroes never had any doubts about themselves.
Oh, okay, okay.
And who would have any interest in this character who is constantly doubting himself, constantly second-guessing himself, always with a kind of wry sense of humor about himself. He even puts himself down in very funny ways and times during the books, and that was considered unacceptable for an action hero. But I'm not really interested in writing about the next mesomorph who Schwarzenegger could play in a movie. It's just not the kind of characters who interest me.
Well, the last few Odd Thomas books have been compelling, but they also seem like they're moving towards something big. Do you have any hints you want to drop as to what we can expect in Saint Odd?
Well, Odd returns to Pico Mundo, the little town he was born and raised in and that he left after book two, because he said he had to go wherever he was taken. Then he's coming full circle, and this book, he realizes that circles are really the basic patterns of life. We're born into the world, we're born out of it, and everything comes around again, and he's back to Pico Mundo. He's going to encounter the same kind of satanic cultists that he has encountered in the first one, but they're going to be more clever than ever. And in the first book, he was made a promise with the woman he loved. They received a little slip out of carnival fortune-telling machine that said you're destined to be together forever. And that didn't turn out to be true, but in fact it will turn out to be true. It's why we keep publishing that little card in the back of each book in the series, because it's a promise made and it will be kept, and people will be kind of surprised how it's going to be kept.
Okay. Well, that's intriguing enough. And I should say, over the weekend, I watched the Odd Thomas movie on Netflix, and I was I enjoyed it very much. I was happily surprised. I thought the two leads, Odd and Stormy, had a great chemistry together, and everything was really well done. Were you happy with the movie?
I was very happy with the movie. I was more happy to have had the pleasure of meeting Stephen Sommers, the director and who wrote it. Just the nicest man I've ever met in film, certainly the highest level of integrity and honesty and just all-around goodness. He's a good family man, and he never once told me something that didn't turn out to be true. And he had terrible struggles getting this movie made. I won't go into them, but not everybody in the business is as forthright and upright as Stephen is. And so he ended up having to make this movie for much less money and to basically give up all of his compensation in order to get it finished.
Oh, my goodness.
And he did all of that. And the movie you'll see on Netflix isn't quite his final cut. Something has been done to it. I'm not sure what. But I still like the movie very much. I think he stayed with the truth and the essence of the character in the story. And the two leads, I think, are really quite wonderful. Anton Yelchin is excellent as Odd, and Addison Timlin is an enormous screen presence, I think.
Yeah.
And I met them both after I saw this in a test screening in a regular theater with 500 people. Then met she and Anton afterward, and Gerda and I and my assistant Linda and her husband were all there, and we met them. And as we were going out, we were talking about their performances, and we all were so taken with Addison and Anton. But we were talking, we thought, gee, she's probably like this 5'10" supermodel because she has this spectacular screen presence, and she's about 5 feet tall. and very, very sweet and unpretentious. And so that was kind of a joyful thing to discover.
Well, now, should we expect to see any horror novels in your future set in the world of movie making based on your experience, your negative experience here?
For some time, I've been writing afterwards to some of the earlier novels, about 20-some of them that Berkeley publishes, and I have just sort of told the truth about the stories that happen, lots of them with film producers and directors, and everybody who reads them writes me and says, that was so funny, how much of that is true? And I say, look, you can't make up Hollywood stories that are better than the real thing. It's an absurd world, and a kind of very dark one. And so it's a struggle to be involved there, and that's why it was such a pleasure with Stephen Sommers, because he was so genuine. And I just wish the movie had been given a chance to be a major theatrical release, but
right.
For many reasons I can't talk about, that didn't happen.
Okay. Well, you mentioned Odd Thomas coming full circle before. Let's come full circle now. My last question, what is your hope for people who read The City? What do you want them to get out of the novel?
Because it came to me as this strange gift where I don't know where the characters came from, and it just unfolded almost as if it was I was in a what psychologists call a flow state. There was no struggle with this story. There's certain things I discovered it was about basically as it was going.
Okay.
And I think one of the big things is we're living in times where it just seems the world is falling apart. And I know so many people are depressed about so many different things these days. And when I went back to, I lived through the 60s. I mean, I graduated high school in the 60s. I graduated college in the 60s, got married in the 60s. And yet when I went back to research some things, thinking I remembered all of it clearly, what really struck me was that the world was falling apart during the 60s. And when I started looking at the race riots in major cities, the war in Vietnam, but more than just the war in Vietnam, it was one thing after another. And I realized, what we have to recognize is what we say so often, those of us with faith, is that we live in a fallen world, and we understand that. But I wonder sometimes if we do fully, because we lose track that what we're living through is what we've always lived through, and it is a fallen world, and it is always going to be a tumultuous world until it's rectified. And in this case, it was kind of, a relief for me to be able to go back and look at the 60s and write about them and say, okay, I lived through that and all the years since, and we'll live through this until we move on. And that then ties to Jonah's story. Jonah has to endure on a personal level what the country and the world is enduring on a larger level. And Jonah endures and gets through it as well. And so I think basically that becomes one of the underlying themes of the book, that all we need to do is persevere with a good spirit and hope. And there's something that Miss Pearl, you mentioned this character, I had a review that said she was sort of a fairy godmother, and I burst out laughing. But, well, that's somebody who didn't even finish reading the book, because they would then know it wasn't a fairy godmother. But but Pearl says to him, and no matter how many terrible things happen, no matter what may go wrong in this day or that day, everything will be fine in the long run. Now, that sounds Pollyanna, but she, what she really means is the long run.
Yes.
And that, I think, is what the book tries to tell you. It's you know, deal with the troubles you have to deal with, but don't lose track of the beauty of the world.
Right. I'm Tony Rossi. You're listening to Christopher Close-Up. I've been talking with Dean Koontz about his books, The City, about the book Innocence, also about the Odd Thomas series. And as you can tell from listening to today's interview, Dean is more than just a suspense novelist. He's a master storyteller who incorporates philosophy, theology, truth, art, beauty, and so much more into everything he writes. The City really is a wonderful tale about Jonah Kirk growing up in the 1960s and his family. Yes, there's crime and violence and murder, but there's also hope amidst all those things, which is pretty much the world we live in today. We need hope amidst all those things. So check out Dean's book, The City, and all the others. And Dean, thanks so much for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me there. That was great.
Now, before we end today's show, here's a message the Christophers would like to share with you.
Throughout Scripture, we hear that God is kind and merciful. And we see in the stories of the gospel what that mercy looks like, as Jesus unpacks it for us via parables and practice. But how can we live out the concept of mercy in our world today? To answer that question, the Christophers have prepared a news note called Blessed Are the Merciful. It highlights the kindness, forgiveness, and love that result from practicing mercy and offers suggestions on ways we can integrate mercy into our lives. To request your free copy of Blessed Are the Merciful, send an email to radio@christophers.org or call our toll-free number at 1-888-298-4050. That's 1-888-298-4050. We look forward to hearing from you.
In closing, I want to thank all our listeners for tuning in today, and I encourage you to visit our website at christophers.org to learn more about the Christophers and to download free literature and podcasts. When you're there, you can also find links to our blog and our Facebook and Twitter pages. And if you have any questions or comments about the show, you can send an email to radio@christophers.org. Our engineers for today's show are Josh Solomon and Brian Bonifacio, and I'm Tony Rossi, your host. Thanks again for joining us, and remember that it's better to light one candle than to curse the darkness.